She'll feed you shredded carrots that have been inside her housecoat. But when you want to wander from her houseboat in the harbor, she will tie your feet together and explain that she's your mother, though you know that you're an orphan. You'd like to reason with her, and you'd like to reason hard, or you'd settle for some bingo, but she's rubbed out every letter in your card, etc. I wrote that. I think I should record it.
Hi, this is Mike.
And Amy.
From New Star Books. Welcome to Happy Hour Symposium Number 1. Our summer intern, Amy Van Vyck, cooked up this project, and we have a lot more planned for you. Stay tuned for forthcoming episodes with a whole bunch of New Star writers. The concept is simple. We take a couple of interesting and talented writers and lock them in a room with a live mic and some drinks.
Except that this episode was recorded at the Vancouver Public Library, which has a strict no-booze policy, but awesome recording facilities. This episode features George Bowring and George Stanley, two prolific writers with many excellent books of poetry under their belts. We spent a couple hours with them in mid-August and had a great time. That was George Bowring you just heard singing his poem, Susie.
And you're about to hear them in a wide-ranging conversation that touches on the Cascadian poetry movement, Captain Vancouver's tryst with Captain Quadra, and who's the better poet. You can tell these guys have been friends for decades. It's a lively and engaging conversation. So sit back and have a good time.
Well, anthologies are books of flowers.
Are they?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You had a book entitled Flowers.
Yeah.
You were hoping to get into an anthology. Is that it?
I've been in so many anthologies now.
Yeah. Partly Irish anthologies?
I've been in gay anthologies, Irish-American anthologies, Northern BC anthologies. Yeah.
So they've got you covered. I was in at least one gay anthology from a section from my novel, Burning Water, in which Captain Vancouver and Captain Quadra have a single-sex, is that the right adjective? Experience.
Same-sex.
Huh? Same-sex.
Same-sex.
Experience.
Yes,
yeah. Right. Experience. So you see, that's a fiction. I've been in American anthologies. Why are we talking about anthologies? Is it my fault?
I think that was the first word that someone said.
Anthology.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was...
I was thinking they take up so much space in my CV.
Yeah.
Right. I would rather have a CV that had, you know, most of it works that I had written, but no, it's most of it is anthologies.
Yeah.
Right.
I decided a long time ago not to even mention those in my CV, because I got so many other things.
Uh-huh.
Right? But what's it? CVs. Speaking of CVs... That looks like a guy. No, no, it can't be that guy. He's dead. Oh, that's not going to... Oh, dear me. This is not going very well so far. Okay. I'm going to ask you a serious question.
Oh, good.
Okay.
All right.
When you first came to Canada, which was, what, in
1971.
71. What was the experience you'd had before then of Canadian poets? I know that other San Francisco poets had come here in the previous
almost
2 years.
Almost none.
Yeah.
I really don't, I can't, I this is not a poet, but I remember reading a story of Stephen Leacock in an anthology in high school, but I don't think I knew the name of a single Canadian poet in 1971.
Wow. And since that time, you not only came from like the cosmopolitan United States or the very hip San Francisco up here, but then you went even farther, you went up to northern BC. You went to Terrace, which has never, as far as I know, produced an anthology of Canadian poetry up till that time. That's to say, and Prince George, you sort of identified yourself.
Yeah, we had a small anthology, and this was back in 1980s or so. It was called Four Realities, and it contained, Belford, McKinnon, myself, and Barbara Monk.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All Northerners.
All Northerners, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And before, for a little while before that, you were living in Vancouver. Afterwards,
yeah,
you identified
yourself
with Vancouver. Yeah, and now you kind of are swallowing Paul Nelson's idea of Cascadia. Yeah.
Well, Paul Nelson's idea, which is the idea behind his new anthology, Cascadia is a bioregion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. At one point, as the editor of the Cascadia anthology, and Ursula Vira as the publisher, it almost came to blows because Ursula was thinking that his idea would sort of compromise her idea of Canadian citizenship.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What do you mean? That's interesting.
Because there apparently is a group backing the idea of Cascadia that is openly political, wants to eliminate the Canadian and U.S. governments.
It's an anarchist kind of thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
See, it's curious that the tradition I grew up in was partly influenced by Charles Olson, who tells poets to dig as deep as they can into their own condition, their own place, especially geographically, as he did. And so we tended it when we were running Tisch magazine to have all kinds of, I don't know, all kinds of associations between exploration of geography and exploration of poetry and exploration of your own physical condition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, we seem to have made a connection between us and people who could teach us stuff and people who were parallel to us in the Bay Area, but nothing in between, nothing in Seattle, hardly anything in Oregon.
Yeah, well, that's
odd.
That is literary sociology, which is a really uninteresting topic. But
yeah,
it is true that there's been this connection for many decades now between San Francisco and Vancouver poetry, whereas Seattle, I think, is more connected with Iowa City and Minneapolis and Atlanta and places like that.
So we associate with the San Francisco, with most of the San Francisco poets, or the San Francisco poets that we are interested in, because of their aesthetic.
Well, we go back to the original split, which is 1960, the two anthologies, New American Poets by Donald Allen, which are, I'll say something about Helen Vendler in a minute, but the other one was New Poets of England and America. It was edited by Donald Hall and
somebody else,
English poet who I can't remember.
But
those are they've actually been referred to, I remember, in an article, maybe it was the London Review of Books, as the two teams of American poetry.
Yeah, because there was nobody that was in both books.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was not only it was not only intentional, but highly instructional.
Right.
And I'm glad you brought it up, because if somebody asked me, what is the difference between you and Al Purdy, even though he's a friend of yours, I would say, look at these two anthologies, right? Or the difference between an Iowa poet and a wherever poet, because it's not a question of geography. The New American Poetry has a New York poets section, made up of guys from the Middle West, guys from Oklahoma.
Tish is in a way a descendant of, or a cousin of, the New American Poetry.
Yeah, Tish started less than a year after that anthology came out, and certainly it was.
And it comes out down also to universities. That is, a lot of us and a lot of them both became university instructors and became heads of departments and had the power to decide who comes to read, et cetera. And so Steve Evans at the University of Maine was telling me about this, that we had people at Arizona State and at Hawaii and several other places.
Yeah.
He was telling me, I think, that maybe I could get a reading in Hawaii. And then he said, no, that guy's not there anymore. You know, one of the other team is there. But I was reading in I guess this is the London Review or the New York Review. It's a review of Helen Vendler's essays on poetry. And she is the outstanding American critic of poetry. And the review is by Charles Simek, who's a very good poet, I think. And
considering he's one of them.
At one point, he's summarizing some of Vendler's views on poetry, and he says that she had no interest in the American primitivism of William Carlos Williams and his followers. So that means that the leading American critic of poetry at Harvard considers our team to be beyond consideration, of no interest whatever.
Yeah. That's really peculiar, because I always have this experience when I'm in the U.S. and talking to people in that read poetry or teach poetry or anthologize poetry or whatever doing, I'm always astonished that they don't think the major poets of my time were Creeley and Levertov and Olson and before that, Powell and Williams and H.D., that they think that they're minor poets somehow or another. And there's a parallel in Canada. If you go to Toronto over and over and over again, you will find people in the literary world talking about the A-list, which is a term they use in Toronto.
Yeah.
They refer to both Robert Croce and Sheila Watson, the people I think are the two major writers of modern times in Canadian literature, as locally interesting poets or writers, as regional writers somehow, as local writers, not as national writers.
Yeah, well, that goes all back to the regionalism of Canada, where you can be an Alberta poet, where it's kind of hard to imagine someone being, say, a North Dakota poet.
Yeah. Well, right. There was a kind of a New England business going on.
And Texas and California like that.
And I always thought New England was, when I was a kid trying to figure out what was going on in poetry, I used to buy my books of poems in a pool hall in Oliver, B.C., because there's no bookstore there. Mm-hmm. But the pool hall had magazines and drugstore paperbacks. And in those days, there were mass market anthologies of poetry, the year's best poetry, et cetera, uh-huh. right? Or the first book, the first book of poetry I ever bought by a single writer was Damon Runyon's Poems for Men, which I bought in the pool hall in Oliver, uh-huh. B.C., right? Why was I saying? Oh, yes. So I would go in there and I'd get this anthology and I'd say, okay, who are these American poets of this year? And I would get like guys like Booth and so on, right? That and I had no idea that there was a split between the unimportant folks that came from the Williams stream and the really important poets that came from the T.S. Eliot stream, right? I had no idea that was going on. It took a long time to sort that out. I don't know how I got started. Why did I get started?
Well, both of those teams are still going in the U.S., but I've had the impression in Canada that the other team, the more academic or maybe it is the A-list, that really it has seemed to me in Canada, maybe I'm misapprehending, that there's only one group of poets. There are not two separate groups of poets in Canada, are there?
Yeah, there are, for sure.
Are.
That is to say, I don't think there's any, would it be any reason to take all those poets that are in Victoria and associate them with you and me and Daphne Marlowe and Fred Lund and so forth, right?
Yeah.
They're the people whose heroes are people like Theodore Retke, right?
So let me ask you about two poets. What about Alden Nolan? Does he fit in the A-list or?
Alden Nolan was a poet that I recognized as belonging to us.
Okay.
Right? But other people might not agree with me.
I agree. And what about Margaret Avison?
Margaret Avison, I think, is our leader. She's the one who started us.
Right.
She began us, right?
Right.
And it's curious that one of her earliest and most important publications was in Sid Corman's magazine.
Uh-huh, right? That's right. I remember that.
And no other Canadian poets were in Sid Corman's magazine that I remember.
Here's what I've said, and you can disagree with me.
Disagree with you.
The best poets, best Canadian poets were Margaret Avison and John Newlove. And now that they've both passed on, the best one is Leonard Cohen.
Ah, interesting. I think I admire Leonard Cohen for some reasons, but we don't have a similar aesthetic.
No, that's true.
And for me, that's I can't help it, having a similar aesthetic. Like, I can admire a poet from another world.
Right? Also, the most underrated Canadian poet is Barry McKinnon.
He's not underrated. Everybody loves him. He was nominated for the Governor General's Award 20 years ago. How can that?
maybe he just thinks he's
for his book, The Thought, right?
Right. Yeah.
No. I don't think you can say anybody's the most anything or anybody's the best something or other. Right. Now what you're doing is you're saying something that would be an answer to a question from...
From the Proust questionnaire.
Yes, from the Proust questionnaire.
Right.
Someone would say, who is the most underrated poet?
Most underrated French novelist of the 19th century.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. But what about the future of poetry? I was talking to Stan Persky about this.
People are always asking that, right?
Stan Persky and I came to agree with this, that poetry will go on, but literature is over.
Literature is over?
Literature in the sense that poets, like Shelley, for example, you would think of Shelley as a great poet as analogous to Mozart, as a great composer.
Yes, I would.
So you would think in that in terms of the fine arts.
Yeah.
And that sort of dwindles away until you get to the, you can, I think it was just a very recent thought, you can read in certain poets that they're trying to be great, like Matthew Arnold, like maybe both Robert Lowell and Robert Duncan, or maybe Irving Layton. And at the same time, you have other poets who couldn't give a shit whether they were great or not. Charles Olson, Jack Spicer, they're thinking of something else entirely.
Yes.
Or T.S. Eliot, also thinking of something else, not of that sense of, am I one of the A-list?
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
Yeah, that's not a totally misdirected group of thoughts.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, you've begun. You haven't finished.
Right? I've finished for so far.
You're finished from working that one out.
Working that one out. Yeah, right.
I think one specifically when it comes to if you face that question and take into consideration the effect on it of business. The book business, the printing business, the things that make people less interested in those things because they've got, like nowadays, for instance, if you look at most university weekly newspapers, what are they reviewing? They're reviewing popular movies and games, right? And rock and roll music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I was there, we were interested in literature, art, cinema, as opposed to popular movies, etc., etc. So I think that what's going to happen with poetry, say, forget about literature for a second, and I kind of am happy or I'm satisfied with that, is that unless there will be fewer, for one thing, it doesn't get reviewed anymore. Right? Nobody reviews poetry anymore. Hardly anybody reviews poetry anymore.
Right.
Even when I was a young guy in publishing, I published a book of poems when I was, say, 35, and 25 newspapers across the country, including smallish cities on the prairies, etc., would review it.
Yes,
right. Now they don't anymore. No, you probably get one review, maybe, of a book of poems. I don't care. Because, fewer and fewer people are going to be buying it. Fewer and fewer people are going to be reviewing it or writing about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what's going to happen is it's the reading and buying of poetry is going to be something for people who are interested in a fine art rather than, what did Pat Lane have to say this week, but are interested in a fine art the same way as people who will go to Italy and go and look at paintings instead of going to the nightclub, right? See what I mean? Writing, and the same thing will happen, I think, with other parts of literature. Now the small presses are the people who are publishing the new novels, whereas the large presses are the ones who are publishing, they have to take it to their publicity people and see whether this is going to sell or not, right, before they'll publish it. Nowadays, these days, people who have published, I know two novelists who have published many novels whose publishers dropped them because they didn't think they would get any prizes.
I was just at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and I found out there that among undergraduate cohorts, the largest number of undergraduates are in pre-med. The second is creative writing.
Yeah, because we really need a lot more creative writers.
But,
right?
most of them are into fiction, and their masters would be Joyce Carol Oates. I can't remember the name of that great short story writer that writes very short stories.
But
those people are writing the novels, I guess, to a kind of form. Also, thinking about creative writing. I don't think, and I'm thinking of creative writing particularly with respect to poetry. I don't think that they talk about dictation. I don't think they talk much about the muse or the source of the poem in creative writing classes.
No, I don't think so either. Uh-huh. And as a matter of fact, I think most of the writers who keep getting issued into the world by, say, the University of British Columbia Creative Writing School, mm-hmm. they've all got agents before they even graduate, I think.
Yeah. Right.
And their model is they want to be published by one of the five big branch plant publishers in Toronto and the home of that thing in New York, right? Mm-hmm. Or London or whatever. They want to be up in the shelf there with somebody else.
Yeah.
They don't care about, like, they're not thinking about making people work to read what they're doing. They're thinking
right.
about creating something that people will say, I want to read their next book.
Uh-huh.
Right? Awful. But what that means to me is now the small presses like Book Thug making beautiful objects, small runs of interesting contemporary writing
mm-hmm.
that I think has a condition similar to that of poetry, that they're writing it to create art the way maybe a painter creates a painting, right? Like, there are some painters who want to make illustrations and have, you know, paint pictures of cougars and trees getting ready to jump on a lamb or something. Have 10,000 copies of that with an auto-generated signature on it. There are artists, illustrators who want to do that. But there are painters who know that if somebody buys their painting, chances are they'll never see it again in their life.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think poetry is approaching that.
Well, I don't agree. I think that poetry was at one time associated with the fine arts. I don't know, maybe the fine arts, the whole concept of the fine arts is disappearing along with literature. But I do think that poetry will go on because, I mean, when we were kids, I think there were less than 200 or 300 poets around. And now there are tens of thousands of poets and magazines everywhere.
Yeah, and publishing themselves on screen.
And I've always been democratic about this. I had this disagreement with Robin Blazer because I told Blazer that I thought that there are good poets in Vancouver and there's probably good poets in Kansas City. And Blazer accused me then of underestimating my own poetry by saying that. So Blazer was more of an elitist, I think.
Yeah, I'm an elitist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, that's the difference between us.
With a small D.
Yeah, right. Well, okay. I'm encouraged by the knowledge that the greatest English poet of all time, Shelley,
yes,
published his books in editions of 250,
uh-huh.
which is less than... That used to be the magic number in Canada when I was young. Like the small presses would do poetry in an edition of 250, right?
Yes.
Sometimes they would claim on the book an edition of 500, but that was a lie, right? That was to satisfy the Canada Council or whoever was responsible for this getting published. And then it went up to 500 and sometimes even 1,000. But I'm okay with that. I have no problem with publishing. In fact, I'm kind of interested in publishing some things and restricting it to even less than that, maybe 50, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just hoping that this little, send an envoy, oh, go out into the world, little book, and I hope that somebody opens a box and finds you in the year 3,000 or something. I'm not a Democrat, so that's why I don't. Do you publish online? Do you let people online publish your poems?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that potentially 100,000 people can read it.
I guess so.
Speed on
it, but I'm not interested in it. I think of it as ephemeral.
Yeah,
We should read some poems.
Okay, read a poem.
All right.
I'm going to read The Flood, so
okay.
Choose wisely.
Well, you are going to read The Flood, I see.
It's 35 pages long.
Well, I was going to talk about what it means to be a poet, which is because I was thinking that it's not an ordinary occupation. Like I was like being a dentist or a librarian. You can't imagine a dentist not practicing for say for 6 months because he wasn't inspired.
Yeah,
you know.
That was interesting. Wouldn't that be neat? Wouldn't it be neat if everybody did that?
Yeah. So I mean, dentists and librarians and other people who have actual occupations, they go through a period of becoming a competent dentist, say, which is a lot different from poetry. I find that poetry is something like an addiction, you know, that I started doing it and I found that I enjoyed doing it, and then a couple of people encouraged me to do it, and here I was, it had now taken my life over.
Yeah.
It was the main thing I was doing, and whatever occupation I had, mostly teaching, was secondary.
I think, too, also, if I'm right, I may be wrong about this, I think you write now more than you used to.
No.
That's not true?
Over the years, no matter what the situation has been, whether I'm working or whether I'm not, whether I'm happy or not, it's about 8 poems a year.
Yeah, but I think that's... I remember you telling me that in the early 1970s.
Yes.
But it seems to me that I'm running into more George Stanley poems nowadays in new volumes than one used to. Seems like you might write like 15 or 20 poems a year.
I write books.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and yeah. I've got a book going called West Broadway now that I've got about 20 or 30 pages of over the past 2 years.
And it has a relationship to your Vancouver book.
It is a sequel to the Vancouver book, yeah.
Hmm. Oh, here comes something. I don't know what, but here comes something. Oh, wait a minute.
It may be water.
Wait, George, take your hand off there. No, not here, you idiot. People will see. I just made that last part up. Okay, yeah. Now, what were we saying? So we're just getting into something serious, I think.
Being a poet,
yeah.
Being a poet and how many poems a person writes in a particular length of time. Well, you are one of the champions. You've written over 100 books.
Yeah.
How many of them have been poetry? About a quarter of them?
Well, see, some of them are short. Some of them sometimes there were three. Like, I used to write books, like small press books.
Yeah.
And then maybe, on average, three of those would be gathered into a book by McCall and Stewart as a big book. And I did that pattern for quite a while.
Well, that counts for 4 books.
Yeah, but as right. but
I mean, my little book, Seniors, became part of the Vancouver book.
Yeah.
That counts for 2 books.
Yeah, okay, what about north of San Francisco?
North of California.
Yeah, Street. That one. What about North of California Street?
Well, that's one book.
Yeah, but it's got all the stuff we've seen before.
Yeah, and those all count as books too.
Hey, our water is coming.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so we don't have to say anything sensible for it. We can open it from the inside. Can you now read pictures on your computer, or are you still working with that 1921?
No, pictures, but not voice.
Because I have a picture of the cover, and it's just a lovely cover.
Right.
It's a little George standing in the snow with skates around his neck and a kitten standing behind him. Okay, here we go. What do we do?
Okay,
wait.
So
are we talking right now?
Yeah.
Look what it looks like when you shout.
You're not going to be here as an audience?
Oh,
we need you. We need you here.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, we need to show off.
You should both stay here.
Okay. Cool.
Right.
We need to show off a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to read a couple of poems.
Oh yeah, that's right too.
So I guess I'll read one, then George will read one.
Well, I thought I'd just read a section from my children's novel.
Whatever. I mean, I'm a poet. George is a poet, but George is more than a poet. He's a writer. And you know what? How John Cocteau defined poets. Poets are writers who don't write. Whereas writers, like George, get to their computer, I don't know what time you do this, George, 10 a.m., 11 a.m., and you're there until, what, 3? Whereas poets only write when they're inspired.
That's not true.
Well, it's true of me, anyway.
That's not true. It's not true of you.
I have poems on my mind all the time.
Yeah.
right now...
I agree with you totally about the muse, by the way.
Right, and or dictation, which
yeah, dictation.
Or the
and
Martians,
some people
or,
don't,
or whatever yeah. it is. One of my masters over the years has now the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, and in her diary, at age 70, she writes, "Poems keep coming all the time, and I keep chasing them away, waiting for a genuine line."
That's wonderful. That's really
so.
Good.
That's where I am now, waiting for a genuine line.
Yeah.
I'll read very.
You don't write in lines, George.
Huh?
You don't write in lines.
What?
You do not write in lines
I
anymore.
I very definitely write in lines. No,
you write dash, write dash, write,
yeah,
write, write dash.
And also paragraphs, because I got that from William Carlos Williams of Patterson.
Okay.
But generally, in a poem like Veracruz here, see, it's in lines.
Oh, are you going to read the Veracruz poem?
Yeah.
That's not fair.
Why?
Because that's a great, great poem, and it's going to stand out, and nobody's going to remember anything I said. It's not fair.
Well, I guess I shouldn't read it then. I'll read it.
It's all right. I don't mind being demolished.
Because I can tell the story of it.
Yeah.
It is the story of it, but because it's a poem called Veracruz. It was written in Veracruz, and it was a completely dictated poem. I was sitting in the Pink Panther restaurant in Veracruz, having a lunch, a club sandwich, and the poem started unreeling in my mind. I went back to my hotel and wrote it.
Why weren't you having red snapper with Veracruz sauce?
Veracruz, yes.
Yeah.
Veracruzana. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, wonderful. It's got olives and tomatoes and garlic and pepper and so.
Yeah, it is, right. Veracruz. In Veracruz, city of breezes and sailors and loud birds, an old man, I walked the Malecón by the sea, and I thought of my father, who, when a young man, had walked the Malecón in Havana, dreaming of Brazil. And I wished he had gone to Brazil and learned magic. And I wished my father had come back to San Francisco armed with Brazilian magic, and that he had married not my mother, but her brother, whom he truly loved. I wish my father had, like Tiresias, changed himself into a woman, and that he had been impregnated by my uncle and given birth to me as a girl. I wish that I had grown up in San Francisco as a girl, a tall, serious girl, and that eventually I had come to Veracruz, and walking on the Malecón, I had met a sailor, a Mexican sailor, or a sailor from some other country, maybe a Brazilian sailor, and that he had married me, and I had become pregnant by him, so that I could give birth at last to my son, the boy I love.
See, already in that poem you're doing that thing that I keep trying to imitate you, where you can hear him thinking, right? And then the next portion of the poem is a thought about that thought.
That's right,
and
yeah, yes.
And so forth, right? And you say, oh, Jesus, I'm right here during the composition of this poem.
That's right, yes, yes.
Which proves my adage that there's no difference between reading and writing when it comes to poetry. It's the same thing. It's the same act.
Why don't you read one of the first poems in The World, I Guess? You have a group of maybe 8 or 10 poems in there. They're all knockouts, but...
Well, I think it doesn't... Unfortunately, my favorite one of those was one of the earliest I wrote.
Let me look.
But it was in a previous book.
Uh-huh.
That was called I Like Summer. I wish I could memorize poems the way some people do. Actually, I have one poem memorized. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, if I have but one life to live, I hope this ain't it.
Right, yes. That is great.
Yeah. But that's not so much a poem as an invocation or a prayer. What, are you trying to find one?
I'm trying to find
You're trying to find one that's any good, right?
No, they're all good. I was trying to find someone that one that I remember had some really interesting shifting of words in it.
Well, you see, the one
well,
called...
You pick.
The one called I Like Summer... I think, is that the one that has a whole thing where I finally find out what Scrapple is?
Is that in this book?
No, that's in my previous book, darn it.
That's in Teeth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Oh. Okay, here's one. The Maltese Emma. I once knew where that title, how I got that title. Now I don't remember. Because there's a Maltese Falcon.
Yes.
Which is a great novel by, what's his name, the great detective writer. And then there's the Maltese.
Dashiell Hammett.
Then there's a Maltese something by Harry Matthews, the Maltese.
Uh-huh. So you mean you have a poem, with the title of the poem, and you don't know where the title of the poem
The Maltese
came from.
M.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Surely it tells us something that more people read Paradise Lost than even begin reading Paradise Regained. Things used to be different, but now more people say, oh, hell, than say, heavens to Betsy. Of course, a lot of those nice old names have fallen into disuse, like spats or sugar tongs. I was thinking of reading some more Milton because his name starts with M, as does Marlowe, whom I am reading now after a long hiatus. Have you ever noticed that hiati are getting longer these days? And really, there isn't one, not a true one, because I didn't read Marlowe so much as be the kind of person who has read Marlowe, who went sometimes as Merlin, as does the wise wife of my longtime friend Dave McFadden, whose books of poetry I've been reading for all our adult lives. Dave believes that paradise is here right now, all around us, and so he absorbs it and bears witness that life is not all subway noise and undersalted eggs. Heavens to Betsy, I say to him, more people confess willingly to reading your books of poetry than even know about Paradise Regained in any edition. He smiles like a bodhisattva who will have no specific religion until time leaks out under the door. So that goes that kind of.
Well, I mean, that's just the opposite. That would be, yeah. Like my poem that I read keeps, as you said, keeps turning back on itself. And this is one of your poems where you, it just takes off.
Yeah, it's a for example poem.
Just hell bent for nowhere and never turns back.
Yeah, until the very end.
Yeah.
Well, it says, "Paradise Regained again, and heavens to Betsy, and so on."
Yeah, right.
It's like. It's kind of like Coleridge's conversation poems, in a sense, that the only thing that directs it or validates it is the fact that somebody is speaking with the expectation that somebody's listening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be yourself most of the time, right? Like, when you're writing... Somebody once asked me at a Simon Fraser. Not Simon Fraser.
Oh, this sounds like it's going to be a good question. Ask this one.
This was a caller. They said, who do you write for? No, who's your audience? And I said, I am.
I think of myself
as an audience, listening to whoever is saying these words for me and getting them down, right?
Yeah, and the source is dictation.
Yeah.
And... Spicer, of course, is the one. I mean, dictation is not a great new idea. The idea is the muse.
Yeah.
But people somehow got Spicer's idea of dictation mixed up with Georgie Yates's idea of automatic writing.
Well, that's partly because Spicer, in his four lectures and on the lecture on dictation, use Yeats as an example.
that's probably the reason.
Yeah, his great examples were Yeats and Rilke, right? During that lecture. Both, I'm not fond of Rilke as a person. I'm not even crazy about him as a poet. But I keep coming back to him, as you know.
He's the best French poet in German.
Yeah.
Yeah, or but anyway, when I was at New York at the launch of Spicer's Collected Poems, and I had to say something, I corrected people who had been saying this, who had been talking about dictation as if it were automatic writing.
Yeah, that's not.
No, I pointed out that there's no conflict between dictation and revision, because you may have to revise to get what Spicer would call, what harms a poem is you have all your crap in there, all the things that you want to say.
That's right.
And you may have to revive to get that revised, to get that stuff out.
I know Jack once said, if you if you find a line in your poem that you really, really like, get rid of it.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
And I always tell my students, I don't have students, but I always tell younger writers and so forth that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And be brave enough to do it. Just destroy it, right?
Another thing about writing poems that I remember, that the question is, well, how do you know it's a good poem, or how do you know you finished the poem? And the answer to that was given by Frank O'Hara. He said, I know that the same way I know that a pair of pants fits.
Yeah,
so it really is. It's a kind of a proprioceptive sense of as though you were inhabiting the poem.
Yeah. You know, does it ever happen to you that you just say, somebody interrupts you or something does when you're writing a poem, and so you put it down and you say, oh, I'll come back to that when I'm in a good enough condition to do it, when I'm ready to do it. And then you do go back to it and you pick it up and you say, I can't add anything, it's done. And that goes along with whoever it was that said, you don't finish a poem, you abandon it. And I'm very mistrustful of the idea of finishing a poem, because you're going to wind up finishing a poem the way Robert Frost does, and consequently lots and lots of Frosties did, right?
Yeah, well, Robert Frost is a great poet.
He might be a great poet, but
his imitators are not.
But he's a bad poet at the same time. Like, he's miserable. So, I mean, I used to teach him.
Yeah.
I would teach a course that had Robert Frost, Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, and H.D., right? And almost every year, the students at the end would say, why did we waste those 2 weeks on Frost?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether they're picking up on me
or
whether it was just like they saw what was happening with the other poets and saw that. But it's true. Like, Frost always, he always has to sum up at the end something.
Yeah, right?
And offer a little wisdom. He's like Aesop, right?
Right.
He has to say, one could be worse than a swinger of birches. Birches?
Right, yes.
Right, yeah, well, I took the road.
You did a kind of a parody of one of that, of Frost, didn't you?
No.
It's somewhere, something you can pick up almost anywhere, and it goes across. I have time, I have long.
Oh, yeah. Have been to Ludlow Fair. No. It's like, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village. Oh, no, my horse is lovely, dark, and deep. No, my horse. What was that where he says, my horse must think something's queer to stop without a farmhouse near. I said that it leads up to my horse is lovely, dark, and deep, right? But it has the same rhythm exactly as, oh, I have been to Ludlow Fair and left my jockstrap God knows where and carried halfway home or near pints and quarts of Ludlow beer.
Yes.
And so on, right? Oh, Terrence, this is stupid stuff. I will not stand for all this guff and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
That guy, I actually read a little bit of him lately, and it wasn't all that bad.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with Frost is that his poems have to lead up to an ending, and the ending has to be memorable, and the door has to shut. Like, when I was reading those poems, I always felt like, it's like the end of that poem was like somebody leaving the room and someone said, shut the door, shut, right?
Yeah, and actually that break that we were talking about that goes back to 1960 between the New American Poets and the New Poets of English in America, it goes back much further. It goes back to Frost and Pound.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
to Frost saying that free verse is like playing tennis without a net.
Yeah, and then Duncan came along later and said,
something about
those are very wise words for those who think poetry is a game.
Yeah, yes. Yes, right.
Yeah, and which is ironic because Ezra Pound got Frost his first book published, right?
Uh-huh.
He made Frost, like, and he got Eliot out of the bank. He just kept doing this to people, right, and saying, look, let's fix things so you can be a poet. Right? But Frost is, I find, disappointing.
Yeah, he's not one that, I mean, he's not, like you say, Shelley, number one, and I say number two and three are Chaucer and Yeats.
They're pretty high up in there, yeah, they're I didn't even think.
But Frost isn't anywhere near that.
Yeah, no, I think Frost is totally number two. Used to mean something else. No, it's not fair.
No.
You and I belong to a similar aesthetic, otherwise we couldn't stand each other, probably. And we clearly are both crazy about Spicer, whom for you was a person in your life, and for me it was a person to read. Mm-hmm. And so we have a very similar sense of like who the team is. But you have a lot of things, like you, and sometimes I don't know whether you're kidding or not, right? But sometimes you will champion a poet that I'm surprised that you will.
Like Lowell, Robert Lowell.
Yeah, that would be a good example. Yeah.
But my long poem, San Francisco's Gone, that comes right out of Lowell's life studies.
Yeah.
And I did go back recently and read some more of Lowell. And you're probably right. Lowell's early poetry is really stodgy.
Well, Life Studies was the one in which he had read some Olson and said, I'm going to see if I can do something like this, right? So it's better than he usually was.
Right. And his late poetry is just unbearable confessional stuff.
Oh, God, I hate that stuff.
It's just those two little books, Life Studies and The Union Dead.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, The Union Dead. Somebody wrote a poem called about the rebels, whatever they're called, the Confederation Dead.
Right, this is
the Confederate Dead.
Who
is that? I can't remember who wrote.
It's not Joe. It's not John. Is it John Crow Ransom or is it? It's
No.
Right.
No, it's more of a. It's more.
It's a Tennessee poet.
It's a better poet than that. I think. Mm-hmm. I heard John Crow Ransom give a lecture one time. I could not believe it. He was really old at the time, right?
Yes.
But he was like. He was like explaining to. He would read a part of his poem, then he would stop and explain what iambs were.
Yeah.
I said, oh my God!
Right.
It was sad. I think maybe he was a little demented or something at the time. Maybe. That's always a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to. Of course, I've been to a lot of poetry readings by poets that I don't, and I'm not interested in, just to hear what they're doing, right? One time one year when I was in Montreal, I had a creative writing class. And it had Artie Gold in it, and Dwight Gardner, and some interesting people. And what's his name was in town? Not the other guy, Spender, and the other guy.
Auden.
Auden? Auden, Auden was in town. He was at McGill. So I took my class and we walked up to McGill to listen to Auden's reading. And Auden just read Clara Hughes. Yeah, he explained what Clara Hughes were, and then he read like half an hour of Clara Hughes. And we came back, and those students were pissed off that they'd lost like half of a class, right, to go and listen to this guy read Clara Hughes.
Yeah.
But I guess if Auden is like of a certain age and everything, he can try whatever he wants anywhere he wants, I suppose. I was disappointed too. I'm not a big Auden fan, but I had been when I was first reading poetry. Yeah,
I was when I was a teenager. He was when I was in high school. The official high school books were a big volume of American poetry and a big volume of English poetry, but nothing really later than about 1920, and no new poetry, no modern poetry. So I and a couple of friends of mine began reading Eliot, great older Eliot poems like Prufrock and Auden, the Auden poem about how Icarus falls out of the sky and nobody knows, everybody goes on with their business and doesn't notice it as the boy falls into the ocean.
Yeah, but that's only one of three poems, three paintings that he uses that. And I hate that poem because I always compare it to the Williams poem, right?
Oh, yeah.
But we'd get into a lecture here, which is going to happen, but anyway.
But the poets that have been influential on me, I pick every 10 or 15 years, one comes along. Kavanaugh in the 70s, Milosh in the 80s, and now most recently Akhmatova.
Yeah. What's the matter? You can't read any good Canadian poems? What's the matter with you?
Well,
you've got to read like Russians and Irish guys and stuff.
I remember the day that you introduced me to John Newlove, and I think of John Newlove as the greatest poet.
He was pretty good. Yeah. He was better than me? You can say it right now. You can record it right now.
No, not better than you. But I can quote a two-line John Newlove poem. It's called Love Affair. I'm not in love with anyone. not even myself. It's hard living without hopelessness.
No, I think he's a terrific poet. He and I were contemporaries. We were always, like, when we came on Vancouver, we were the two hotshot poets, right? Mm-hmm. Two hotshot male, whatever, poets.
Right.
And we corresponded with one another, and we stole ideas from each other. He stole a thing I was doing with four-line stanzas that went through, and I stole something. We just, like, did this all the time, right? I thought it was just awful that he went ahead and died before I did, right? So
I guess I'll read one more poem.
Why? I can say that stuff like that because he's my friend.
Right. I'll read this little poem I wrote last year called "The Vacuum Cleaner."
Oh, dogs hate this poem.
"The Vacuum Cleaner." I'd almost finished the vacuuming when the on-off switch that had been wonky for months finally broke. I couldn't turn the machine off. It was stuck on. So I finished vacuuming and unplugged it. Next week, I took it into the shop. A beautiful girl came out from in back. I handed her the vacuum cleaner, the power head, that is, the attachments I'd left at home. And as she inspected it, we began to talk in a friendly way about what I don't remember, but I recall feeling that I was not just a customer to her. The beauty of girls and boys pursues me wherever I'm going. Then I had to take my head in to the clinic. I sat in the examining room waiting for the door to open. Then it did. The young doctor entered and said, "I'm Jason."
That's almost as good as the one about beauty.
Yeah, right, yes.
The one about beauty is, like, probably about in that period, in terms of shorter poems, the second best after the Veracruz one.
Very true. Well, the one about beauty is a very, very serious poem. That's the great thing about "The Vacuum Cleaner" is it's just such a light-hearted poem that has no pretensions whatever, and, you know.
You know, everybody, I think, when he said, "Next week I got to take my head in," everybody's posture goes, "Oh, okay."
Yes, that's right. That's right.
They'd say, "Okay, now I don't have to sit on edge saying, 'Am I going to get this poem?'"
Yeah, and I was working on that poem from both ends. In other words, I think I got the line. I've got to take my head in before I trying to figure out what did I mean when I said I brought her the vacuum cleaner over the power head.
Yeah,
I think that getting that word head, which comes earlier in the poem, I think that was after the latter one. Right.
That's the way poetry works.
Let me see your book again. I'm going to you talk for a minute, and I will find that poem that I like so much for what it does with language.
Well, I decided when I was quite young that I would like to be a poet, and so I said to myself, well, the thing to do is to read those who have been successful in their endeavor to become well-known poets. So I said to myself, okay, well, I will read a little bit of Ezra Pound. Well, I did, and I found out I couldn't understand a goddamn thing he was saying. It was so difficult. So I said to myself, should poetry be difficult? And my answer was, I don't know. Well, later on in life, I found out that, yes, poetry should be difficult. If poetry isn't difficult, why would you bother reading it? How's that so far? I'm reminded of what Toni Morrison said to Oprah. Oprah had Toni Morrison on, and she said in her sort of sucking up way, "Oh, I was reading your new novel, and I found out I had to keep going back and reading over again so I could really get what it said." And Toni Morrison said, "Yes, dear, that's called reading."
Yeah, right, yes. Here it is. This is the poem I like of yours for the way words lead to words. A late smile.
A late smile. I was born in December and now I was born in December and now I'm in the December of my life. Has anyone seen what next year will be like or whether I'll be there at all? I only know I don't want to come to an end of hearing wonderful words like sawhorse. I'm tempted here to go to seahorse and ruin the singular purpose of that wood to seesaw with Marjorie in the sea salt, that girl with the curly somersault my grandfather in Somerset could have taught her. This silliness a poet in San Francisco may have taught me was all right. Sawdust work around barns being so far from ephemeral, which sounds, doesn't it, like a medicine you have to earn your way to by growing old.
Yes, I love that.
Jeez, I wrote that about.
I love all those words.
I wrote that about a year before
horse,
I had.
Seahorse, somersault, Somerset.
Yeah, and there's some that are hiding behind there that I didn't say that I hope people would figure out too. I have a character in this book this is from a series, so this is a third volume, my children's book, called Attack of the Toga Gang, published by Dancing Cat Books in this year, 2015. Anyway, there's a character who these four kids go to. He's a astrophysicist or something like that who works out at UBC. And he's really weird. I can't to describe him would take a long time to explain. But his name is Professor Purzelbaum. And one of the neat things is that if the kids ever looked up what Purzelbaum means in German, it is somersault.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's why you made me think of Professor Purzelbaum. Right, now where are we? Now I'm going to read...
I think we're getting close to concluding remarks.
No, I'm I'm sorry. I'm going to read the entirety
of a flood.
The flood. George Stanley's the only person I know, other than myself, who has read that poem 1.5 times.
I'm going to read it backwards next time.
Okay. The flood is a poem that took me decades and decades and decades to write.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit like Scrapple.
Yeah. Right. The other great poem of yours is the one that when I say it, you say that you don't pronounce it that way. It's Gievik at Sea. But maybe you pronounce it Gwilevik or
Gievik.
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 Oh, maybe okay, Gievik. So the Gievik. Accent is on the first syllable.
I think
Gievik
so.
At Sea.
Well, it's not really on any syllable because though it is a Slavic name, he is a Frenchman.
Yeah.
And in French you don't accent any syllable, so it could be except you can't help it. You sort of automatically do a little bit. This is one of the big fights I'm having with all the young women who are editing my books. They want the word. I say in my hometown or in my backyard.
Yeah.
They want hometown to be one word. I'm saying, if it's one word, why do you have two principal stresses, hometown? It should be hometown or hometown.
Right.
Yeah. I will say hometown if it's an adjective, but I will not say I'm going to my hometown as one word. Or same as backseat, backyard, all that stuff. Drives me. I'm so angry when this happens. Angry.
Rob, well, you just say no.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Right.
I hope that's useful. Now, do you have anything to tell our fans in the way of summing up? What is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life.
Yeah, the meaning of life.
Oh, yeah. Well, I recently read a little quote from Albert Camus about that. We can despair of the meaning of life in general, but not of the particular forms it takes.
That's deep.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, that's philosophical.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The Pursuit of Meaning, have you read that?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either, but I've read Frankl's autobiography.
Frankl?
Frankl, the guy who wrote The Pursuit of Meaning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read his autobiography.
You're a better poet than Pushkin.
Okay. You're a better poet than Marjorie Pickthall.
Marjorie Pickthall.
Yeah.
You're a better poet than Felicia Ward Hemans.
You're a better poet than than Garcia Lorca.
Fade out music here.
Or we can, I know what. Do you want to, that was a game we used to play in the bar when we were with our,
right.
with our young people called.
Right.
But here's the other one that goes like this. I go, 22. 22.
24.
Damn! I've never won this, ever. 17.
40.
63. 67. Damn! We've been playing this game now for ever since the 70s, and I have never I've never once won.
Right. Try one more.
Okay. 4.
185.
You see how unfair it is in life, I mean?
Thanks very much to George Stanley and George Bowering, and especially to the Vancouver Public Library.
You can find Bowering and Stanley's latest books at newstarbooks.com and in fine bookstores everywhere. George Bowering's latest is The World, I Guess, and George Stanley's latest is North of California Street. In forthcoming episodes, we'll hear Julie Emerson and Roxana Bekodoroff talking about 27 Stings, Louis Cabri and Donato Mancini talking about their most recent books, Poshlust and Loitersack, respectively, and Andrew Struthers will be expounding on some of the ideas and philosophies in his latest Around the World on Minimum Wage.
Keep an eye on our page, New Star Books, on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter @NewStarBooks.
Thank you for listening.